The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening. The Greeks had the Oracle of Delphi, and Americans have the Oracle of Fauci. And Dr. Anthony Fauci joins me now. Good morning, doctor. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I am terrific. Thank you for all you're doing for the country. My wife, who we refer to as the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt here, wanted me to say you're a rock star, and everybody knows it.
Why, thank you.
I want to thank, by the way, your wife, Christine, your daughters, Jennifer, Megan, and Allison. They must be worried about you like my daughter's worried about me. Is that true?
That is correct. They really are. I was hoping that wouldn't be the case, but they really are.
Well, you're working hard. I mean, you're making a mockery of all of us who think we work hard in the 60s, but you're in your 70s. I have a question, though. My daughter, who I refer to as Rumpel, she who must be obeyed, is now telling me what I can and cannot do. Is that what you intended to do, to empower children to tell their parents what to do and not to do?
Well, you know, whatever it takes, really, to get done, things done in an appropriate manner. Very often, children, and my own children, I can say for sure, have a significant influence on your behavior. When they come in, they give you a new kind of reality test. So when they tell you to stay home or distance yourself from people and don't go to crowded places, you listen to them. If you sort of see it on TV or read about it or hear about it on the radio, it kind of goes by you without really hitting you. But when your children tell you, that's a different story.
Now, I want to drill down on seniors, my target audience. We got 6 million people listening to this show. The vast majority of them are between 45 and 64, but we got a lot of older people as well. A lot of grandparents, including me, all of my grandkids are under 9. This weekend, I was going to go drive and see them because my daughter's alone. My son-in-law is deployed, and there are 3 kids under 9. And she said to me yesterday, don't come. Is she right?
You know, she is. Right now, what we're trying to do, and you know, yesterday at the White House Task Force press conference, we made an announcement to really ratchet up some of the guidelines for what we call physical and social distancing. And one of them is, if you have someone who is elderly, and particularly an elderly person with an underlying condition, such as heart disease and lung disease or diabetes, that puts them at an increased risk of getting the complications of coronavirus if, in fact, they get infected, you really want to protect those vulnerable people. So the guideline, as stringent as it sounds, I know is appropriate because it has worked in other settings, is to essentially have these individuals, the elderly, self-isolate in the home for at least the next 15 days to see what the direction of this outbreak is. And that means physical separation. Now, you don't want to make someone so socially lonely that their life is miserable, but you want to physically separate yourself from them because a young person might go out into the community, get infected. And we know now from good experience with China, with South Korea, and now most recently with Italy and France, that younger individuals who get infected tend to do very well. Some of them have minimal symptoms as opposed to the chance of getting into trouble. So a young person may go out, get infected, and inadvertently come back, and by physical interaction with the elderly or those with compromised immune systems, might actually infect them. And then the consequences are much more severe than a younger person getting infected.
So, Dr. Fauci, I'm going to use myself as an example, and we'll expand from there. I'm 64. I'm in terrific shape. Just had my physical. Ran 7 miles on Kauai a week ago. In fact, the Spouting Horn. I know you run every day, 3.5 miles. I've got runner's back and a tear and a rotator cuff, but I'm in great shape. My grandkids are healthy. You would still tell me, don't go visit them.
No, you know, I would tell you the following, that in as a general guideline rule, you should not. But, you know, when you talk about the elderly, particularly if, as you say, you are otherwise really quite healthy, you know, there's a numerical age and there's a physiologic age. And some people who are 55, 60, are really kind of, you know, compromised because they don't age well. Whereas some people 75 and even 80 who are vigorous, athletic, and they do well. So when you get a guideline and have a cutoff and you say, well, if you're 70 years of age or older, there really needs to be some flexibility in interpreting that. I mean, if you want to be totally safe, then you overshoot and say, okay, I'm 60 years old, I'm 65, but I'm very, very healthy, but I'm still going to self-isolate because even though I'm very healthy and I have no issues or problems, I'm not going to take a chance.
Well, let's expand it out, doctor. We've got seniors who live for golf and who live for tennis, and they've got regular golfing partners and they got regular tennis partners, and they want to go to their club and they say, oh, it's all very clean and I'm only going to see the caddy and I'm only going to see the bag boy and I'm going to play 18 with my friend who's also very healthy. Do you want them to stay home?
Well, in general, yes. But
perfect.
Again, with exceptions, for example, you don't want people to have crowds that are 10 or more. You don't want to say after you've been one-on-one with someone, you then go to the bar and have a few drinks with 50 people in the bar.
Yep.
Those are the kind of things you don't want to do. But if you want to bend on the side of caution, I would say even though it's relatively low risk to go out and mingle with a few people for now, for the 15-day trial period, I think it's the better part of valor if you are an elderly person to just hunker down for a couple of weeks, see what the trend of the outbreak is.
Now, I'm going to just pause one more time for the 60-plus crowd and especially the 70-plus crowd. Can they go to the market? Can they get their hair cut? Can they go to the pharmacy if they just go and come back?
Well, again, it is some flexibility, but for the most part, it depends on how that person feels. If that person is an otherwise healthy 60-year-old, yes, they can go out to the market. What I would do is do it at a time when the market is not crowded. Do it at a time when there are not a lot of people there. But the default rule would be to self-isolate yourself.
All right, bigger question now, Dr. Fauci. You are like a character in John Barry's The Great Influenza, like Dr. William Welch, or The Ghost Maps, John Snow and Henry Whitehead. Those are books about the 1918 to 1920 pandemic and the cholera outbreak in London in 1854. I love public health nonfiction history, even though I'm a lawyer. I love this stuff. Are you aware of being a character in a book that will guide future people about how to handle inevitably future pandemics?
You know, I really don't think about it that way. I'm so intensely involved in what we're doing with the task force here and trying to raise the awareness of the American people. I don't think of hardly anything else but the job I'm doing. I'm not thinking ahead about books and characters and things like that.
Well, the reason I want to ask you to do it is because the more we know about what this task force does, the more it will inform the next pandemic. Do you agree with me about that, that we learn from the behaviors of governments in the face of crises, what to do and not to do?
I totally agree with you. In fact, many of the lessons I've learned over the years with attacking the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the early 1980s, the anthrax attacks, the threat of the bird flu, the Ebola, the Zika, all of those things that I've had the experience, I would say, the privilege of being able to participate and help in, those have all informed how I do things now.
Is that the president, Dr. Fauci? If it's the president, we can we'll yield.
Well, it isn't the president, but it's
okay.
Close.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to yield then. If it's Mike Pence telling me we're talking to you, Hewitt, and Mike will, the vice president will understand. I want to get your advice. You're a good Catholic kid, Our Lady of Guadalupe, Regis High School, as am I. I want your specific advice to the church and other churches. My diocese in Arlington issued a dispensation to 60-year-olds, don't go to Mass. What's your advice to priests over 60, to non-religious pastors of other denominations, kind-hearted people all over, whose natural inclination is to serve their flocks?
Yeah, I think that they should, again, the default, that they should do the guidelines the way we have for others. There are 65-year-olds and 70-year-olds like myself who have jobs that are important in the community and that are service, that you have to say, well, for the most part, people at this in this group should stay home. But some people have jobs that can't do that. So, I mean, I wouldn't make a strict rule for an older priest. I would tell the priest that make sure there's nothing that happens in the Mass, services, the Eucharist, the wine, the host. None of that should endanger people from an infectious disease standpoint. So there are certain things in the Mass, a congregation I might call off if you have people coming together in a church. You know, even individually, it would have to be suspend certain aspects of the Mass. Certainly drinking of wine from the chalice, I would really be careful about.
Now, Doctor, I want to close with you. Senator Cotton's coming up pretty quick. But the big unanswered question, because I don't know that many members of the White House press corps have actually read The Great Influenza, is that between its appearance in Kansas in the spring of 1918 and its devastating second wave, it went through 12 iterations, according to John Barry's book, and the second and third and fourth, they got deadlier. The hardest question for me to answer is during the summer when the virus appears to disappear, will it be iterating into a more deadly virus? Is there any science to tell us if we're getting crowd immunity or if it's going to come back in a more virulent form?
You know, we do not know. When we suppressed the SARS coronavirus, it went away and never came back. We are hoping that if we can suppress this by mitigation and by containment over the next few months, that when we get into the deep summer, that it will disappear. If it doesn't and come back, hopefully that will give us more breathing room to develop therapies as well as a vaccine. But the straight, but the direct answer to your question is we do not know if it will come back and how it will come back. It's a possibility, but we just need to be prepared for it.
I was cheered yesterday by the record-setting initiation of a trial on a vaccine. I am curious if there is other good news on interventions for those who are suffering from virus pneumonia and related, there are some pretty awful related maladies. Are there any new interventions that have crossed your screen?
Oh, there are several that are in clinical trial. They have not yet been proven to be effective, but there are a number of interventions, what we call therapies, direct antiviral therapies, that are being tested in China and some that are even being tested here in the United States.
Now, my last technical question has to do with the CDC and the testing breakdown. Was that because of regulatory capture? Was that because the CDC always prefers its own work? Was that simply because I think what the president was saying yesterday is, while we've confronted Ebola and H1N1, we've never confronted as fast a moving virus as this one before that is so elusive to diagnose. What happened on the testing development?
You know, it was a complicated series of multiple things that conflated that just, you know, went the wrong way. One of them was a technical glitch that slowed things down in the beginning. Nobody's fault. There wasn't any bad guys there. It just happened. And then when the CDC realized and the FDA, that both the system itself as it was set up, which serves certain circumstances very well, was not well suited to the kind of broad testing that we needed the private sector to get involved in. The regulatory constraints, which under certain circumstances are helpful and protective of the American people, were not suited to the emergence of this particular outbreak. So there was a confluence of a bunch of things. I believe now that the CDC and the FDA and the department, that we've got it right now because we're handing much of it over to the private sector, the heavy hitter companies that do this for a living. And I think what you're going to be seeing looking forward is a major, major improvement in the availability of testing.
Was the glitch or anything about the production of the test President Trump's fault? Or actually, let me put it more broadly, would every president have run into the same problem?
Oh, absolutely. This has nothing to do with anybody's fault, certainly not the president's fault.
And that brings me to my last question. What is it like working with the president? You've worked with a lot of presidents. And by the way, I got two questions. I lied. I have two more questions. What's it like to work with the president?
It's an interesting experience. You know, each president has their own unique character. He's a, somebody who is, you know, very active, a lot of things going on, very direct, very decisive.
And so my last question is about Tony Fauci. You could have retired years ago and made bank. I mean, you could have gone onto every board of every publicly traded pharmaceutical. You've probably given up $100 million in lost opportunity costs, what economics would call that. Why?
Well, I'm a public servant. I mean, that's who I am. I am who I am, and I've been a public servant for decades and decades. I love it. I love the challenge. And to be quite honest, I mean, that money does not mean that much to me at all. I just need enough to get along and get up and go to work. And what I do, I get a great deal of gratification of. So, I mean, the idea about how many millions and millions and millions I would have, you know, not had, it doesn't faze me. I don't even think about it.
And is that the Catholic in you? Is there a teacher back at Our Lady of Guadalupe? Is there a nun back there who taught Tony Fauci?
Well, there's a nun and there's a bunch of Jesuit priests, too.
Oh, they're Jesuits? Oh, my gosh. I'm not sure. You're making news there if it's the Jesuits. Very last question. The Pope took a walk, Dr. Right. Fauci. What did you make? He's 83 years old. He's out walking around. There's surface infection, right? Is that what the Pope should be doing?
Well, you know, the Pope is a very special person. He has things and responsibilities to his flock, if you want to call it that, that sometimes supersede things of self-protection.
So you're not, well, okay, Tony Fauci, I'm not going to ask you to criticize the Pope. I appreciate your spending time with me, Doctor. I think those are great guidelines, and I think you're getting compliance. I lied one more time because Tom Cotton's not here. There were thousands of college kids in the water in Florida yesterday. I'm sure you saw the picture. What's your message to them?
Yeah, I would tell them, please, please, even though you yourself feel invulnerable, being in crowds, getting infected, you may inadvertently bring the infection to a vulnerable person who might be your father, your grandfather, your sick uncle. Take care. We all have to be in this together. This is a, you know, all of country pulling together to get through this.
Should they go home?
The kids, yeah. They should just get out of crowds. That's what they should do.
I will leave it at that. I'm going to pass it off to Senator Tom Cotton, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Thank you. You are wonderful.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, Senator Tom Cotton, I'm not going to say you're wonderful. You guys have work to do this week. Good morning, Senator.
We're going to be working busily all this week because we were working over the weekend, frankly, with you. You know, we had to shut down my office and my workers telecommute because of the virus hitting the halls of Congress. But we haven't been taking a break at all in this national crisis.
Let me ask you, what is going to happen to the House bill? And there is an expectation from Jake Sherman and David Drucker and others that the Senate will pass the House bill and then will immediately work on their own bill, which they will send to the House with the expectation that reciprocity in the attention to relief and stimulus bills will be mutual.
Well, I hope that doesn't happen, Hugh. It may, but I hope it doesn't, because the House bill has some bad flaws in it that will actually make the situation in a lot of our workplaces worse. So the centerpiece of the House bill when it comes to helping affected workers is a new kind of tax credit through employers for sick leave. That doesn't go big enough. It doesn't go far enough. First off, there are a lot of people who are not sick who are affected and displaced by this virus. Maybe their business is in furlough, like restaurants and bars and theaters, or maybe their child has been sent home because the school is closed. They're going to need some financial aid, just like someone who has the virus or someone who has been quarantined for exposure to the virus. Likewise, I have doubts that a new kind of tax credit that uses employers as a middleman will move quickly enough to get cash in the hands of those people who have to put food on the table this week and pay the bills this month. So there's at least a couple different ways I think we can move faster. We could use the existing unemployment insurance system that we have in all 50 states that is designed to get checks out fast to people in need. We could use the tax rebate, tax refund system for all taxpayers last year, probably capping it at a level where we're confident that people above that level can weather the storm get checks out in that way. So the House bill can be improved. Plenty of good stuff in there, but it can be improved. We should take a pause. We should play the role that our founders intended for the Senate, be the sober second thought to a quick-acting House and make this bill better for the American people.
I think you're going to be overruled in that, Senator Cotton, by 60 senators. So assuming that I'm correct, if there is a second Senate bill, will it go farther and faster than the House bill did, which I believe, by the way, is not up to the crisis that we face? The House bill will not do what they hope it will do. And if it passes, will there be another bill?
So I believe that if the House bill passes as is, which, again, it should not, that the Senate will begin acting quickly on another bill that does go farther and then does look at some longer term impacts beyond just helping people affected this week and next week. Because we have to remember, this is a fast acting crisis, and the way the world looked last week is very different from the way it's going to look next week. So if the Senate just passes the House bill, I'm confident we'll begin working on a third bill that will go farther and hopefully be better than what the House passed.
Now, Senator Cotton, is the goal to make whole the people? I have personal experience of this. I run the Nixon Library. I've had to send people home, but they haven't lost money. They haven't been injured. The library has been injured, the not-for-profit. Is the goal, in your mind, to make everybody whole who has been injured economically by virtue of the Great American Shutdown is?
Hugh, the goal is to help people get through this crisis. So if you're home because you're sick or you've been exposed to the virus or your business is furloughed, we want to make sure that you have enough money to put food on the table for yourself and your kids, keep the roof over your head, and pay your bills. If you're the kind of white-collar, salaried worker that can telecommute and whose business is still generating revenues, you have less need for that kind of subsistence support. But we want to make sure that everyone goes home that should be home and has no financial incentive to go back to their workplace or go out and try to find more work to make ends meet this week.
Exactly. And Jeff Bezos and Hugh Hewitt and a whole millions of Americans need no help at all, but the cab driver who drove me from National to my home when I came back on Sunday had one lift that day. How are you going to help him?
Yeah, that's right, Hugh. And that's another reason why I don't think the House bill is structured goes far enough and fast enough. Again, it just focuses on people who are employed and who take sick leave. What about all those self-employed individuals, all those contractors, all those people who have seen a rapid decline in their income as well? That's why I think a better approach is simply to get cash payments or cash equivalents directly into the hands of anyone who's been affected by this crisis through existing infrastructure and programs like unemployment or like the tax rebate system.
Okay, I have a slightly different take. I think a put-up-your-hand system that trusts people to say, I lost X dollars, pay me, like the 9/11 fund would work. But let me ask you about the bigger issue of stimulus. Getting the car started again. Needs gas and it needs oil if it's been left idle for a couple of weeks. You got to make sure it's filled and it's ready to go. Part of that is, I believe, charging the battery. And part of that is general stimulus, which I believe should come through defense spending. I mean, we have a top line need in the Navy. I'm sure you know what it is. I'm sure you know all that. Is there any thought to using this opportunity to stimulate the economy by virtue of doing what we need to do anyway, which is refill our readiness needs and build the forces that we need?
So, Hugh, I've heard you make that case on the radio this week, and I think it's very much worth considering. Obviously, it won't have a generalized impact across the country, but our defense industry is pretty dispersed across the country.
Yep.
Some companies that are major defense contractors are being significantly affected by the crisis. For instance, Boeing has seen a significant decline in orders of its wide-body aircraft. Boeing is also a major defense contractor. You have a lot of areas in the country, likewise, that have small and mid-sized defense contractors as well. So your point is well taken that while a general stimulus measure, like, say, postponing the tax filing date for a few months from April 15th, or letting individuals file extensions would influence all regions and all industries of the country, but we might want to look at some specific sectors like the defense industry where the taxpayer will have something concrete to show for those investments on the back end of this crisis.
Excellent. Now, last question, Senator Cotton. No false humility here. I was the first guy talking about this in January because I'd read The Great Influenza, and you were the first elected official who took it seriously. In my humble opinion, you were first. We knew that the People's Republic of China would not be forthcoming because we know the regime. Now they are attempting, through a focused propaganda campaign, to change the narrative and to rewrite history, which communists always do. What is your response to General Secretary Xi and all of his minions who are actually actively engaged in information warfare on a generalized basis?
Well, first, this is one of those things that you wish you would not have been correct about. But I could tell in mid-January, before this virus was even reported in the Western media, just from reports from East Asia, that it was serious. I'm not an expert. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an epidemiologist. But you could tell from the way the Chinese Communist Party was lying at the time and the extreme measures they were taking how serious it would be. You can tell that now as well because they are actively trying to claim that this virus did not originate in China. That's one reason why I call it the Wuhan coronavirus or the China virus, because when the Chinese Communist Party is engaged in active disinformation operations with its own people and around the world, we have to stand up and be crystal clear that they are responsible for unleashing a plague on the world, and they will face consequences on the back end of this. China needs the United States and our market and our economy a lot more than we need China. And all of those jobs and all of those factories that went to China over the last 30 years, I will predict, are not going to be there much longer.
Now, what is the obligation of the American media in the face of active disinformation campaigns from a peer competitor to report what they are doing? There was some shaming of people who used Wuhan flu or China virus that failed quickly. It was coming from the left. It was a political attack on the president and the center right. But it's vanished because I think they are aware. But what is the responsibility of the media to keep this part of the story in front of the American people?
Well, Hugh, the rich irony is, and I'm sure you've seen the collections online or the clips on cable news, that almost every mainstream media outlet in January and February, like CNN and MSNBC and the Washington Post and the New York Times, was in fact referring to this virus as the Wuhan coronavirus or the China virus or what have you. Then they decided they wanted to use it as a cudgel against their political adversaries. They were being politically correct fools. At this point, now that China is engaged in active disinformation operations, it's incumbent upon our media in America to explain to Americans what our adversaries in the Chinese Communist Party are trying to do.
Last question is about President Trump. He gave himself a 10 out of 10 yesterday. Dr. Fauci just explained that the testing fiasco had nothing to do with him, nothing, and that every president would have had the same problem. How do you rate the president's handling and what is going on in the media's questioning of him? It's almost it's almost evidence every day of TDS.
Hugh, I'll leave grades to the media and, more importantly, to the voters when they cast their ballots across the country. I'm focused on trying to get us through this crisis. I can tell you that President Trump in January, after I'd spoken to him on several occasions about shutting down travel from mainland China, made the bold and decisive choice to do so against the advice of many of the so-called experts in his administration. That is not what they call part of the public health playbook. Suggest we should rewrite that playbook, but that was a bold decision that the president was being counseled not to do. I think everyone recognizes now it was the right decision, and it has significantly slowed the spread of the virus in this country.
We have 4,600 cases. I know you've been tweeting, be prepared to act, as Alameda County did yesterday, and issue shelter-in-place orders, stay at home, and enforce it with public health authorities. That surprised a lot of people, Senator Cotton. So I just want to give the last minute to you. Why are you taking such an approach that surprises conservative, freedom-loving Tom Cotton is saying, get ready, you may be told to stay home and you're going to listen?
Because, Hugh, I want everyone to look at what has happened in Italy. 2 weeks ago, Italians were enjoying early spring weather and they were sipping coffee and wine at restaurants and bars. Today, elderly Italians are being denied care at hospitals and administered last rites because their healthcare system is totally overloaded. I know that kind of national shutdown or quarantine or curfew, whatever you want to call it, will impose hardship. We can take steps to mitigate those hardships. We can help the economy get back on your feet, but we can't get your life back. We can't get your parents and your grandparents' life back. We need to act aggressively now to save lives tomorrow.
Senator Tom Cotton, thank you.
Thank you, Hugh.